Welcome to In Real Life, the podcast brought to you by the Big Picture Film Club, a platform for independent films and original stories. Here we learn about our guests using the medium of film and television. This week's guest has played a key role in British publishing. He was the head of marketing for Waterstones, MD for Harville Press and Castle, and is the co-founder of Unbound, the crowdfunded publishing company. However, he is most well known for his role as the co-founder and as the head of research for the hit BBC TV series QI. A warm welcome to you, John Mitchinson.
Lovely to be here, Jules.
You have commonly used the phrase when talking about QI, if it's not interesting, then we're even more interested, or something to that effect.
Yeah.
What is quite interesting about you?
Well, I don't know. I have a very low boredom threshold. I don't know whether that makes me interesting, but it's why I've always been. I was the sort of kid that would start reading an encyclopedia at A and read it all the way through to the end.
You'd actually get there.
Just for sheer kind of cussedness. Or also curiosity. I just love learning about things. And asking, you know, increasingly annoying questions to the adults that were attempting to raise me. So no, I've always had that kind of mind. And I've got quite a retentive memory, so I tend to hang on to things. But I think that the curious thing about children is I can't remember who it was that said we spend the first 5 years of their life teaching them to walk and talk, and the next 10 telling them to shut up and sit down.
So true.
Encouraging curiosity, which is what we have always tried to do with QI. And it's also why I love being a publisher, and I love finding and working with authors. And I like writing books, but I also love publishing them. And it's kind of, you can publish more books than you can write.
We're going to get on to your publishing career just in a moment. Your father was a dean in rural Oxfordshire, which is still where you call home today. And you chair the parish council there. Is that right?
Yes, it's technically called a parish meeting because our village is so small, there's only 150 people on the electoral roll. So my swinging powers of kind of, you know, executive control are quite limited, really. But yeah, I live in a small village called Great Tew and have lived there for 22 years.
How much did your father's vocation influence your childhood and what you were exposed to on television and what you did in your free time?
It's an interesting one. I mean, my generation kind of were the first generation, I think, who really grew up with television being a central part of their lives. I mean, we didn't get a colour television until the early 70s, but we had a kind of rickety old sort of 60s black and white TV. And it was definitely the thing that everybody would gather around and watch television. And I remember watching, you know, sport on a Saturday afternoon with my grandfather. And my dad was, my dad loved TV. And it was always a thing, you know, that there'd be sort of rituals around it. We weren't allowed to watch what would be now called Past the Watershed, although I don't think that phrase was used at the time. There were sort of kids' programmes, which we loved, and adult programmes. And there was always the sort of Sunday afternoon Dickens kind of, you know, adaptation slot. I remember Ivanhoe was one I watched as a kid, which I really loved. But my dad is, although my dad is a priest, he was very, he's not at all, I wouldn't call him religious. He was kind of as much a sort of firebrand Marxist agitator as he was a man of the cloth. So, you know, Songs of Praise was not something we would be watching in our house. He's now 83, but he still loves, you know, political argument and debate and shouting at the television. I suppose that was a kind of golden period for, it was the beginning of sort of politicians using TV as a way of talking to the nation.
Yeah, and realising how powerful the media
can
be.
I still really clearly remember watching the Nixon kind of resignation as a child in 74 and thinking, this is incredible, this is like...
It's the best drama you can get, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, television was really important part of growing up. And, you know, it's funny because you hear everybody talking about how it's consumed now. My boys don't all sit down and watch TV as a family very often. Maybe Game of Thrones.
Well, of course. Game of Thrones, yes.
That lovely, fun-filled family show.
Full of flaws. So you went on to study in New Zealand at Selwyn College and then, yep, and then on to University of Auckland.
We emigrated from... My dad, also slightly restless human being, I think, was... We moved a lot when I was a kid, which was I mean, the issue with that was just having to make new friends at school. But the move in the end of 75, we emigrated to New Zealand, to Rotorua in the North Island. That was a massive change, cultural shift, everything, new country. But I kind of loved it. I kind of enjoyed it. I got to like it. I was not massively happy at school at first over there. It's a pretty full-on kind of boys' school in the old English tradition. And I'd gone to a very liberal comprehensive when I was here. So it was quite a big readjustment. But I loved it's so beautiful, fishing and going off and camping and having fun with my friends. I had a great time. And then we moved to Auckland, and then I went to Auckland University for a year. So I kind of did most of my teenage growing up. It enables and entitles me to be an All Blacks fan in rugby, which I played quite a bit of rugby, which is a good thing. Yeah, that's so my family originally come from Sunderland, so my football team is Sunderland, which has been a vale of tears since 73 when they won the cup.
So the greatest thing you could take away from having moved over to New Zealand is being able to support the All Blacks.
Well, that, and actually I was really, really kind of intrigued and interested, and still am, really impressed by Rotorua as the centre of kind of of Maori culture in the North Island, and there was a third of the school was in my Rotorua Boys High was Maori, brilliant rugby school, but also full of, and I wanted to learn the language, and it's just that the times have changed so much. They really advised me as a sort of, you know, a kind of European kind of, they're called Pākehās, Europeans who've arrived, and I was very small and very white, very much looked like a kind of a Northern European boy, and they really advised me against taking it for my school certificate, which I said right, I'll take Maori studies as my elective option, which is brilliant, because I hung out, it was basically me and a bunch of Maori boys, and yeah. I learned a little bit of the language, but I learned a lot more about Maori culture from listening to them.
It's interesting, that would be encouraged now.
Yes, totally. I mean, it's an amazing
schools like SOAS.
It's a massively huge change in New Zealand. It really is. Does feel like a bilingual country now everywhere, rather like Canada. It's a very positive place in lots of ways, and of course they've got the world's best prime minister at the moment. So, but I'm, you know, my mum still is there. My daughter is there. My brother is there. He's an actor out there. So I go back regularly. It does feel like a second home.
So following New Zealand, you went on to study English language and literature at Merton College, Oxford, which set you up beautifully for a career in publishing.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really think it through, I have to say. I went to Merton because that was the college that Tolkien had gone to. And I was a massive, obsessive Lord of the Rings fan. I read it every year through my teenage years, religiously each summer. I loved that. Still do.
Did you know that there was also another John Mitchinson at Pembroke? I think it was Pembroke College, Oxford.
Really?
I don't know if you've heard another John Mitchinson.
Well, the only one
similar to
the only one I know is the singer. There was one of the staples of the third programme was a singer, a tenor called John Mitchinson, who I think was Welsh. But he's the only one I've come across. I did once go to, up in the borders, there's a little town called Stapleton, and there were four John Mitchinsons buried in the graveyard there, which it's not a name you see that often.
No. Do you feel that the literary world has sort of suffered over the years whilst the popularity of online streaming has grown?
I don't know. I think books are unbelievably resilient. I used to do a little talk about the threat to books is always kind of right back into the early 19th century, where, you know, the rise of kind of music hall was going to destroy the culture, and then it was going to be the rise of, you know, the penny dreadfuls, and then it was the turn of the 20th centuries. It was the beginnings of radio, and then obviously what happened, television, film. In fact, what books do is they become, you know, they become brilliantly, they become complementary to what other the new dominant medium is. The most obvious, you know, I think now streaming and the digital world. I mean, e-books have been unbelievably successful, but they haven't killed In fact, they've created, I think, an interesting pressure on physical books to be more beautiful, better made, more desirable as an object.
Visual book.
But it's,
sorry,
yeah, it's,
I mean,
it's true.
Visual.
Yeah, but it's kind of, it's they're sublime. Books are sublime pieces of technology in themselves. They're portable. You don't need a battery to use them. You know, they last a long time. You can read them at your own speed. You can read them in the bath, which is easier than reading a Kindle in the bath, or safer than reading a Kindle in the bath.
So you very much think that there is room for
Yeah,
both.
I think been. What happens is that you know, ideas, stories find ways of kind of covering the whole spectrum. And I think there will be, yeah, sure, there's been a bit of rearrangement in terms of people's attention. But the biggest growth area at the moment is audiobooks.
Yeah.
Which, if you think about it, we're here recording a podcast. Podcasts are going through the roof. Audiobooks are going through the roof because this is something you can consume while you're ostensibly doing something else. That's an amazing breakthrough. You can't watch a film while you're driving.
Absolutely. You can't read a book.
You can't read a book. But you can listen to a book and you can listen to a podcast. And people do. In increasingly huge numbers, I'm very pleased to say.
Yeah. No, that's amazing.
And it's, you know, I think good podcasts tend to be story-based. You know, it doesn't have to be made up stories, but people talking about their lives, people, it's like the best kind of radio. It's radio with its kind of, you know, shirt collar undone and a bit more relaxed. People are allowed to laugh on podcasts.
And of course, a lot of these ideas that we see in film and television, they originate from books anyway.
Sure.
So it's books that have made them what they are.
And I think there are obviously issues in terms of translating stories from one medium to another, but in general, I think, you know, we've probably got the most narrative literate kind of audience than we've ever had. Because I do think, if I look and listen to what my boys do and watch and listen to, they're very, very smart on their character arcs and plot points and this stuff. This arcane stuff that really only people who studied screenwriting would have known about when I was a kid. Now they're all over it. So, you know, their analysis of Game of Thrones might be that, you know, Daenerys, you know, didn't do this or that. But it's often done in terms of whether they think the showrunners have actually got the character
the
arcs
point.
Right and
yeah.
the plot points right. And
yeah.
have they made that a believable scene, or are they trying to hurry it too much? It's really interesting.
Yeah, which does rouse a bit of thought. And
I think that probably is why, maybe that's why, you know, that obviously flips over much more easily into thrillers than it perhaps does into literary novels. So, you know, there are kind of tastes that change and come and go. But a well-plotted, tightly plotted novel, you know, in lots of cases can also, I think, find its way into being a tightly plotted, well-constructed film.
There are an endless number of novel-to-film adaptations. What, for you, has really struck a chord? And you know, what are your favourites and what are your least favourites?
In general, I'm I'm a bit sceptical of... My least favourite adaptation, well, it wasn't my least favourite until it got to the end, was the adaptation of Ian McEwan's Atonement.
Okay.
Which is a beautifully made film, beautifully acted. You know, there was nothing apparently wrong with it, but I just hated I hated in the book as well. I hated the trick of allowing you to think that the characters had a life.
Yeah.
When in fact
of happiness.
They
yeah.
hadn't, they'd been
yeah.
killed.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing that, and that's not, as I say, it's not really a film adaptation problem, but I hated it in both versions. In fact,
okay.
Rachel, my wife, and I, was the closest we've ever been to actual violence.
She completely disagrees with
she
you.
She disagrees. But I don't really like those slightly weedy literary adaptations.
Okay.
You know, that kind of...
But what have you... You must
what
have
I
read...
What I really love is... if you want to ask what I really... I think there are a couple of amazing Dickens adaptations. My favourite... One of the films that made me most interested in film and still kind of haunts my dreams was the adaptation of Great Expectations by David Lean.
Yeah.
Which, as a small child, I saw and was absolutely... I was terrified on all kinds of levels. I was terrified...
It's black and white, isn't it?
Yeah, brilliantly shot. Almost expressionistic in the way that it's shot. It starts with this... it's one of the great openings in literature, but also it's a great opening for a movie. You know, small boy looking at the graves of his mother, father and siblings. And then suddenly there's a convict on the loose. threatening him to get victuals, and then he goes, you know, shortly after this, to this incredibly spooky house where there's this beautiful cold girl who treats him really mean, and he cries, yeah, and she calls him common and coarse, and then there's the mad Miss Havisham with her in a wedding dress. It's like, yeah, what the hell is this? I mean that was, to me, you know, everybody had their Doctor Who moments, but that for me was it really kind of fired my imagination. And oddly, that we've just done recently a backlisted podcast on Great Expectations, because I read it at school and thought it was great, you know, and obviously loved the film, and then didn't read it again until I turned 50. And it was one of the reasons that I wanted to do a podcast about old books, was that I realised that these classics are mostly wasted on young people. You know, to understand that book, you have to understand disappointment. You have to understand how your life doesn't really turn out the way you think it's going to.
This is often the issue with that people who don't like the Marvel and the Avengers things, where everything always turns out okay in the end. You know, it's the winner always prevails. And
I mean, I kind of admire those books as, I guess, as craft, as those films as craft. And I like the ones that, you know, the one that the New Zealand guy directed, where the Thor one, which I thought was really Thor Ragnarok, which was very funny and clever. But it does feel a little bit infantilised, you know, that to have a kind of, I mean,
but they're the biggest grossing things in the cinema right
now.
Sure,
and I think if you want to see great acting and intelligent, when I say adult themes, you know what I mean. I don't mean that kind of adult, but you know, then you go to your long form TV series, and that's probably, thinking back across my viewing life, that's been the biggest shift. I was saying about another Dickens adaptation back in the 90s, the adaptation of Little Dorrit, which is a massive 6-hour film, I think, which is absolutely incredible in terms of rendering the texture and detail of a 19th century novel on film.
How did it manage to keep the audience captivated for 6 hours?
Well, I guess...
Because that, in this day and age, would be a total mistake.
I didn't go and see it in the cinemas. I saw it at home. And I think you can kind of take it in smaller chunks, I suppose. There was also, I mean, it's not always Dickens. I mean, I do think that Sunday afternoon adaptation thing was what BBC drama was sort of famous for, taking all those 19th century novels and turning them into very, very good, high quality entertainment. Great actors.
And then they were drawn out into series, you know, Railway Children and the Famous Five and things like that.
Yeah, it's the adaptation, the book to film thing is, there are some fairly obvious things. If a book is incredibly intensely first person narrative, you know, Catcher in the Rye, I have to say, I do think that the movie To Kill a Mockingbird is a very good movie. I don't think it's as good as the book, but it's books are able to get you inside characters' heads in a way that films aren't. So it's not surprising that the really good thrillers, you know, the great thrillers, the Chandlers, the James N. Cains, have made classic movies, whereas it's quite difficult to look at a kind of a subtle, complex literary novel where there's a lot of interior thought and turning that into something that's compelling.
Back to Great Expectations, though, it's been remade quite a few times, most notably in 1998 with Gwyneth Paltrow starring in it, and of course, more recently, and Mike Newell made it in 2012, and they just weren't nearly as powerful as David Lean's. Why do you think that
is? Well, I think Lean is... I think he's one of the great filmmakers of the century, and I think his visual imagination... I think he takes Dickens' story, which is a good story, and he turns it into a David Lean film. I mean, I don't really... When I think of that film, I think of David Lean rather than Dickens in a funny kind of way, because I think he just...
Yeah.
I think he just... It's brilliant, the landscape. And that, of course, he invents a new ending for the book, which is, I think, incredible drama, where Pip goes back. There are already two endings to the original novel, one where Pip and Estella don't get together, which is, the, in my view, the right ending psychologically. The whole of that book is about Pip not learning to have to...
Disappointment.
Disappointment and giving up on. And but he goes into the house and Estella is sitting in a Miss Havisham's chair, kind of pretending that she's going to stay there for the rest of her lives, and he won't let it happen. He rips all the curtains down, and of course, brilliant, because the light floods in. And he grabs her and pulls her out, and they go off into their life, you know, into the marvellous ending. So that's, to me, all of that works. Whereas there was a recent TV adaptation where there's a scene where Pip and Estella are standing in a stream, waist high, and lots of things that were good about it, but Pip was just way too attractive. You know, he's way too kind of, you know, male model.
Yeah.
And you just... there is always that problem with literature, is that you kind of, you know, you will have your Pip, your Estella, carry those characters, sense of those characters around in your head. The other great adaptation that I would commend is Lord of the Rings. I do think Peter Jackson did
approved of that.
Unbelievably brilliant job. And I can't really think that the new Amazon series will match it.
Well, watch this space. I mean, people will still watch it.
Sure,
but
I'll watch it.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
but I watched the crazy, slightly sexy Ralph Bakshi mad adaptation that he did in the 70s.
For you, though, John, what makes a cinematic masterpiece?
I guess it's that thing of... I suppose it's the use of images in a way that is not, that is sort of not literary, that isn't, you know, it's...
So a full picture, kind of abundance.
If I'm thinking of films that I would count as my touchstone masterpieces, an amazing film from 1966, Andrei Tarkovsky's Andrei Rublev, which is the life of a medieval icon painter who takes a vow of silence. He's so appalled by the violence. He's wandering through Russia, and he's so appalled by the violence that he sees.
He's a progenitor of slow cinema and uses a lot of imagery, and it's sporadic drama.
It's the first time I really understood that the beauty of just, you know, very slow pans, very kind of watching rain. There's a lot of rain. Tarkovsky loves water and rain, and it's painterly. It's black and white most of the movie. What happens is there is the final section of the movie, without giving all the detail, is a young boy who's the son of the bell maker for a town, and he's making for the local prince a bell, and that he knows that the bell has got to be made and it's got to ring, otherwise his life is forfeit. And this incredible scene of how you would cast a medieval bell with medieval equipment. It's like a medieval film. It's like this film has been made by a medieval person with a camera. That's what I love about it. It's so beautiful and so strange and so powerful. And it turns out that the bell rings, and Rublev goes and he finds the boy sobbing outside against a tree, and he says, he speaks for the first time, says, "Why are you crying?" And he said, "My father taught me nothing." He'd conned everybody into saying, "I can cast a bell, my father told me the secrets." And then he says, "My father taught me nothing." And then the final sequence is, then the story is that Rublev goes back to painting, and this final sequence, which is blaze of colour, are all these incredible masterpieces of Russian icons in colour at the end of the film. And you kind of come out of that film and you know what you think is that this is the greatest art form that human beings have yet created, that to create something as pure and as powerful emotionally but also as visually impressive as that.
It seems to me like all of these cinematic techniques are in order to rouse what we now refer to and are practicing today and learning about is mindfulness.
Yeah.
Kind of that sort of lack of action, that stillness, and that appreciation for something as it is.
That's very interesting, because Another great favourite film, which just also happens to be in black and white. I don't know why. It's not always the case. I've got other ones that are in colour. Is Raging Bull by Scorsese, which I think is his... I think it's a towering masterpiece of American cinema making.
It is. Interestingly, Scorsese won the Oscar for The Departed, but everyone, but most of the critics after that said, yeah, but shouldn't he have won it for Raging Bull? Yeah. You know.
Well, I mean, leaving aside, which is, you know, the kind of, you know, the usual kind of Christian themes of you know, redemption and punishment and the beauty, there is just scenes in that film. What he does with the soundtrack, you know, Robbie Robertson's done an amazing sort of selection of films, but the way he, the sound in the movie, it has the aesthetics of a, you know, a kind of new German cinema type of, you know, it's an art film. But it's not an art film story. Mm. It's a big kind of story about a boxer. But some of the beauty, the horrible scene of the blood on the ropes, but also his when he's falling in love with his wife Kathy, Joe watches her legs in the swimming pool. And of course, it's the first time you really see Scorsese using that slow motion thing that he does, where certain scenes. It's almost like to slow your emotion down or to encourage you to look.
And really appreciate what's going on.
He uses it famously when Johnny Boy comes into the bar to Jumping Jack Flash in Mean Streets. But he does that throughout Raging Bull. It's just a very powerful movie.
Mm. Long may he keep making films.
Yeah, so no, I know. And
you know, he didn't want to make Raging Bull. De Niro read the biography for Jack LaMotta, who the story is based upon. He was the real Raging Bull, the middleweight.
He was acted as a sort of a kind champion. Of slightly trucking and script consultant, I think. For
yeah. And he was on the set of The Godfather Part Two and read it and loved it and said, "Hey, Marty, you've got to go. You've got to read this. And Scorsese said, "Well, I'm not really sure what to do with that kind of thing. That's not really my thing at the moment." But managed to convince him, and hey, presto!
Yeah,
he's got something incredible on his hands.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. It's. I mean, of their many collaborations, I think it's the one. Mm. It's the best.
Your crowd-funded publishing company, Unbound, has now grown from strength to strength over the last 10 years. What gave you the foresight, particularly in your 50s, if I'm allowed to say that, to set up something notably progressive for its time?
Probably denial of being in my 50s would have been a good... I had always said, once I'd left publishing, for all kinds of reasons, I didn't want to go back into it. And in a funny kind of way, I don't really feel I have. I mean, the actual story is very simple. I was working quite happily on QI. I got a call from my friend Dan Kieran, who had been, he had helped make the first QI website. And he said, I'd love to go out for a drink. He said, "I've just had my book turned down," which is a bit of a problem because, you know, he wrote a very huge best-selling book called Crap Towns. He and another writer called Sam Jordison, which was a Sunday Times bestseller and was the classic thing of getting English people to write about my town is worse than your town, and it became a sort of national competition almost.
I see you, I raise you.
Yeah. Mm. Hull won for that first book. Anyway, he had had this really interesting book turned out, and what had happened is that publishing had gone through a sort of a spasm of fear post-recession in 2007-2008, and I guess we started having conversations about how was this possible that really good books by writers who had a track record. I mean, this Dan had written 10 books. And then it turned out that our other friend Justin had also had a book that had been rejected. So I kind of had, at this stage, was hanging out for reasons I can't quite remember, but with there was a whole sort of group of people in London, Michael Acton Smith, Tom Boardman, Alex Chu, who were sort of Web 2.0 people. And it was out of that conversation that I learned about a new crowdfunding site called, well, I said new crowdfunding site, it was a crowdfunding site called Kickstarter. And sort of interest in that, you know, that's a kind of really interesting way of making creativity accessible to people. You know, you kind of get the money from your fans. This had already happened in
made so much more sense.
It had already happened in music. But then also I kind of got quite excited because I thought, well, this is how it used to work in publishing in the 18th century. You know, if you wanted to write a novel, Mrs. you know, Fanny Burney would advertise.
And great example.
And get her. Well, the reason I bring up Fanny Burney is that her book Camilla is the only place where Jane Austen's name appeared in print in her lifetime. She was a subscriber.
Oh.
So all these, I'd sort of...
That is quite interesting.
No, having studied literature, I knew that there was this idea that if you subscription in advance, you got people to subscribe. Dr. Johnson did it for his dictionary. You got people to pledge in advance, and then when you got enough money, you could go ahead and write the book. So I said, well, if we could use the internet to do that. So Dan and I and Justin, over a series of, you know, lengthy discussions in the pub, came up with what we thought would... And we managed to persuade Paul Birch, who'd been one of the Birch brothers who'd founded Bebo, which was, yep, remember, Facebook before Facebook. And he gave us £50,000, amazingly. And we made our first kind of prototype website. It had a terrible, terrible name when we started. We didn't
Bookfester.
Not work before we launched. Yes, you remember that?
Of course I do.
you mustn't tell anyone. Oh, it's now I've confessed on my podcast. Anyway, funny enough, I went on a holiday to New Zealand and
No, but it made sense, Bookvesta, and it was clearer.
I'd been thinking about books and bindings, and I said, what about bound.com? Mm. And I think it was Justin who said, I think we might attract the wrong kind of...
Yeah, quite.
So he said, I think it was him who said, what about Unbound?
Especially you have Soho offices, yeah.
And that was it. Unbound was the... And
amazing.
And we, yeah, it, so... I don't think it's changed really in its essence all that much. I think we
apart from it's just grown. It really has. You've got nearly 40 employees now.
Yeah, we've successfully funded over 442 books now, and we've had bestsellers and we've had awards. In fact, we've got a book that up for the Rathbone Folio Literary Prize on Monday. So it's as I said earlier, I think I you know, the low boredom threshold, publishing lots of different books. And crowdfunding's great for that because you get all kinds of weird and wonderful ideas. And I think that's the thing I love.
That wouldn't have even got past the the envelope test.
It's trying to find the new. It's always what I've been interested in, is to look forward to find stuff that hasn't yet. You know, when we had a phone call from Sean Usher in the first week that we were training, and he said, I've got this website, Letters of Note. And I said, I know your website, Letters of Note. I love that site. In fact, you're one of the targets. That and another site called Retronaut were on my target list of books, people to approach. And, you know, Sean's not an author, but he's a brilliant curator. So we went to see him and he loved the pitch that we had and said, look, let's make it a fabulous...
Isn't that one of your best-selling books?
Yes, it's still our
best-selling
book.
It is, yeah.
I think it's sold in all its various editions now over 500,000 copies worldwide. So that's again, it's being able to see things that don't exist, which always interests me. And publishing is too often looking backwards and trying to reproduce things that have already worked.
And it's kind of the same premise in which that you kind of founded QIs, using information that had sort of been discarded by other people, interesting.
John's kind of original conception of QIs.
And this is John Lloyd.
John Lloyd, who's great, legendary
comedy. Of Blackadder.
Yeah, comedy producer. And I think he had been slightly disillusioned working in advertising, and to sort of self-medicate for his kind of, midlife feeling of depression and emptiness and hollowness, he started to voraciously read philosophy and books on religion, and it was out of that kind of, he suddenly began to realise that there was most of the stuff that's produced is tremendously baggy and full of stuff that you don't need to have. And actually, if you can just get the interesting stuff, suck the interesting stuff out of it, you have a chance of getting people's attention and getting them to think a little bit differently. So QIs sort of...
And that's based on manpower, right? That is surely just trawling through.
Well, yes, I think it's also... I think you kind of learn how to do it. You learn...
Okay, to identify what is interesting.
You learn to know where to look.
Yeah.
And I think we were very lucky. We've had great... I mean, in fact, the team of researchers that we employed at QI went on to, in their spare time, record a podcast, which is kind of, was one of the landmark early podcasts.
Are these the elves that you refer to? Yeah.
Yeah, No Such Thing as a Fish. which they have. I mean, it's world-beating now. They've done a sellout tour. They sold out the Hammersmith Apollo. It's incredible.
Amazing.
I mean, the QI podcast is now, I think, almost arguably bigger than the show, just in terms of they get, you know, I don't know however hundreds of millions of downloads they've had. But it's a fabulous thing.
In a world where something is comparatively, well, QI is comparatively highbrow, in a world where lowbrow has seemed to be, unfortunately, the zeitgeist of the last, 10, 15 years of television, what was it about your formula that you think appealed and worked well?
We don't really, you know, we're talking here and today that finally that vile Jeremy Kyle show has been consigned to the outer darkness.
Bravo.
I don't think I've never believed that what people want is just crap. And I think if you look at the stuff that's lasted, you know, do people watch On the Buses now? No. Do they watch Fawlty Towers? Yes. Do they watch The Good Life? A bit. You know, if you're just talking in terms of comedy, it's amazing that actually the good stuff, people really like the good stuff. And just because they
watch it... Yes, no one's going to watch reruns of Gogglebox.
Just because they watch it doesn't mean it's what they want.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, we made QI very clearly to be the TV show that we wanted it to be. And, you know, and we learned a hell of a lot. The first series was hilarious because we didn't quite know, you know, we knew what we thought was interesting, but we didn't know what would work. And we'd given ourselves this, I think, well, it's an amusing story why we did it alphabetically. But we had everything had to begin with A. And, you know, thinking back to the very first show that we did with Hugh Laurie looking completely bemused. I mean, the interesting thing is we slightly gave, you know, that Hugh did that as we were sort of thinking, well, Hugh hasn't got much work at the moment and Stephen's doing it, so we'll see how it works. I don't think he had a great time, to be honest, but I mean, let's just say he's dealt with that in the years subsequently. No, it was brilliant fun. And I think, God, Danny Baker was on it as well. But we had a very, I think we started to see that that our instincts were right, that what people were people were fascinated information and they wanted information, not just kind of knock out facts, but they wanted stories.
It's nice to be entertained. You've got comedians on the shows.
And our job was to not, we weren't writing, you know, I always say writing a QI script. What you were doing were writing, we didn't even have really crisp notes when we began, but we started to see that what Stephen needed was a card with some other stuff so that he could keep the conversations and open the conversations up and let the jokes
unfold.
I mean, about as far as we got down the road of jokes was, you know, coming up with funny buzzer noises. That was that was a fun thing to do for each of the scripts. And it is very odd now, you know, going back and watching some of the early and remembering, you know, how before the sort of the bones had set, as it were, in what the formula would be. And I still think, you know, it was a brilliant move. Stephen, you know, bowing out and getting Sandy on board. I think she's done an amazing job. And, she's a delight to work with. It's, so the highbrow, lowbrow thing is, I think that QI is pretty... I think John's philosophy of comedy has always been very broad. You know, that comedy is for everybody.
Yeah.
It's not narrowly focused. It's warm and it's generous and inclusive. And I think at the time that we were making it, you know, when things like The Office were coming out, we did wonder whether it was all just a bit too nice. But everybody enjoyed going on the show. And it's very different from 9 out of 10 Cats or any of those others where, you know, it's comedians basically turkey cocking and kind of, you know, trying to, you know, it's about the
information.
The key thing is what? You know, I remember the first Christmas show we did, and Phil Jupitus, we gave him a, you know, which is the odd one out, and none of them were, it turned out to be the odd one out.
Oh, that's just not
what
fair.
What kind of a hellish show is this?
I suppose the rules are, there are no rules.
There was another one. With Phil was always very good on the outrage, where we said, can you tell us when the sun has gone below the horizon? And it's, the sun's coming down, and of course it disappears, and he goes bang, and it's not the last bit. The sun, it's just a mirage. So the sun is already... When the sun is sort of three quarters of the way down, it's already behind. So, again, he's just saying, why, this show is just sets out to destroy the most beautiful thing you can possibly imagine, and you're telling me it's just a mirage. There were lots and lots of very, I mean...
But if you saw that episode, you won't forget, right?
And the other thing, which, you know, I think we were very careful about, we just didn't make it topical.
Mm.
We made it about information. We made it about stuff that we knew that we had been fascinated by as kids.
Yeah, and there's something about time.
And of course, kids now, I mean, it's amazing because kids, I mean, I go into, you know, schools now and I get QI facts, you know, back from the audience. They all know our stuff now. It's like we've become the new...
such a gift.
Well, it is very, very... It's great because it is... We do... Beneath what we were doing, I suppose there was some kind of educational philosophy, which is that, you know, question, don't accept things on face value, that always look more deeply. If you look at something, you know, the closer you look at something, the more interesting it becomes. Mm. And that all the real miracles are hiding in plain sight.
Mm.
You know, the nature of water, the nature of consciousness, you know, the nature of light, all these things that we live with, they become completely invisible to us. And I guess that's, you know, bringing it back to film, that's the magic, isn't it, of film. And you have to pinch yourself sometimes sitting there in a cinema and thinking, this is just all light. This is all this is. This is just light that's been kind of, you know, been organised into this sequence of images. I just find that incredible. I find it incredibly moving. And that's the thing I think about cinemas. Where one of the things I do love, I love a box set, don't we all? But I love...
Favourite box set?
It kind of has to be The Sopranos. I mean, I just don't think anything is...
You're not alone there.
I mean, I know. It's a bit boring to say that.
No, not at all.
It's 86.
There's a lot
and
of
I remember,
content.
The thing I love most about The Sopranos is I remember waking up in the middle of the night once and I say, "What, Rose, what's the matter?" She said, "I'm lying here fretting about Carmella."
Brilliant.
And it is, that's when you know you've got something.
And you're so immersed in it and within the characters.
And of course, like a lot of people, we watched it quite an intensive way. The one that has blown me away most recently, oddly, is a really old one, which is Deadwood.
That was 2004, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ian McShane. He's just Lovejoy.
It's Lovejoy in playing
in a Western.
In a Western. Yeah. And so I was kind of slightly prejudiced against it for a long time because of that.
Yeah, understandably, as an English. Yeah.
But it's so brilliantly written and performed and I mean, but you know. There are so many great ones.
And before we go, best film recommendations of late or of just since Kingdom Come?
Since Kingdom Come.
Anything that you think, if someone hasn't seen it, it's an absolute must-see for you.
Of late, I have to say, I haven't had my socks blown off. There was a brilliant documentary called I Am Not Your Negro about James Baldwin, which absolutely, that, you know, there's very occasionally, again, I saw it on a big screen, and it's just a brilliant bit of work because it juxtaposes what Baldwin was saying in the 60s, and he was incredibly eloquent and remorseless in his kind of skewering of what, you know, you could only call sort of white backsliding and kind of the subtle way in which the African-American experience had been written out of history. And then juxtaposing that with kind of Black Lives Matter. And it's very occasionally you get a documentary film that is properly, viscerally from the heart and important. Mm. I thought that. So it's not exactly a kind of sit back with the family with popcorn, but it's a brilliant film, I thought. But, I mean, I go back, the stuff that I really, really enjoyed, I guess I liked the Alphonse Cuarón, I've forgotten his name, you know, Roma. I thought, well, I kind of like...
You like the black and white. I'm joking.
Oh my God, I do, don't I? It's terrible. I do like the black and white. If I was going to say...
No, that was beautiful. It was so well done.
You know, if I was going to say Desert Island Films, there are two... one's colour, you'll be pleased to know. I love Bunuel, and I love his discreet charm of the bourgeoisie. And I just wish... I wish more people had... I mean, it was a big film in the 70s, but I wish more people would see it. It's basically a brilliant kind of ensemble of middle-class... sort of French Spanish people trying to have dinner being denied that, and it's vicious and it's funny and it's there's so little film like that being made now, that kind of intelligence. And what else? Probably my Desert Island Film is I Know Where I'm Going by Powell and Pressburger, which is a kind of romance set in the war about a kind of London party girl who's marrying an older industrialist on his Scottish island.
Shot in the Hebrides?
Yeah. And it's such a beautiful, beautiful film. And one of the reasons I have a particular memory of it is I went to see a screening of it with a Q&A when Michael Powell, who was in his 80s then, before he died. This is back in the 80s, it was at the ICA.
And Michael Powell's of the Red Shoes.
Yes, of the Red Shoes.
One of Scorsese's favourite films.
A Match
films.
Of Life and Death. Yeah. The Life and Death of Conan. I mean, The Canterbury Tale.
Is not as well known as...
No, yeah. And it should be, because it's the Scottish one, and it's got some amazing performances in it. It's also got Irish Wolfhounds in it. There's an amazing character called Katrina who has Irish Wolfhounds, and she's sort of in love with the hero of the film, played by Roger Livesey, who's Torquil, the Laird of Culloran. If you like Scotland, which I have, and Rachel, my wife, Scottish, it's totally irresistible. And it's also got an amazingly happy ending. So, great, great film. But and Powell had shown the film, and he got up at the end, and there were tears streaming down his face, and he said, I haven't seen that film for 40 years. And that was just, it was one of those heart-melting moments. And you think, his wife, of course, is Thelma Schoonmaker, who is his third wife, I think. Thelma Schoonmaker, who is Scorsese's editor, edited Raging Bull. And so there is a kind of close Powell and Scorsese connection.
That's interesting.
But, yeah, I feel a bit feeble for not recommending stuff.
No, don't. You've given us a wealth of interesting films.
That's more recent. I mean, I could go on about New German. I could go on about Fassbinder. I could go on about, you know, Werner Herzog movies.
I think you've given us a lot of food for thought, and you know, there's some unusual choices in there. And it's been absolutely wonderful talking to you here on In Real Life. Thank you so much, John Mitchinson.
Thank you.